I had assumed that the summer night would have the same job I did, just for a different crew. I hadn't really thought about actually crossing swords with Fix, metaphorically or otherwise. 10 years ago, that possibility wouldn't have fazed me. But Fix wasn't the same guy he had been back then. He was the summer night, and he was currently standing up to a champion of the White Court and the winter night without batting an eye. I recognized the calm in him, the stillness that was almost like serenity. It was focus and confidence. He knew the danger. He didn't want to fight, but he was quietly ready for it, and ready to accept whatever consequences it might bring. It's generally a really bad idea to fight guys who are in that particular mental space.
"You want me to run him off?" Thomas asked.
Fix's eyes didn't move from me, but he directed his words at Thomas. "Come try it, vampire."
"Stars and stones," I sighed.
I took the Winchester and put it gently back into the Hummer. "Fix, can we stop the high noon routine? I'm not going to fight you." He frowned slightly. "That sort of remains to be seen."
"Thomas," I said, "get back in the truck, please."
"What?" "I want to talk to Fix, and it isn't going to be a real productive conversation if he has to keep one eye on each of us and his fingers by his gun in case you draw on him."
Thomas grunted.
"Suppose he draws and shoots you as soon as I'm not backing you up."
"If that happens, and if it'll make you feel better, you can come fight him, I suppose."
I regarded Fix for a moment and then said, "But he won't."
"Harry," Thomas said.
"He won't," I said quietly. "I know him. He won't."
Thomas let out a low, growling grumble, but he got back into the Hummer and shut the door.
Fix eyed me warily and checked his surroundings quickly, as though expecting some kind of ambush. I sighed and sat down on the rear bumper of the Hummer.
"Fix," I said.
"Look, I've been doing this job for about 6 hours now. I haven't gone all dark side. Yet."
Fix folded his arms. His fingers were still close to his weapons, but a little farther away than they'd been a moment before.
"You've got to understand. Lloyd Slate was a real monster, man."
"I know."
"You don't know. Because you never had to face him without power, the way we did."
I spread my hands.
"I didn't always have power, Fix. And even with it, there are plenty of big, scary things out there that I'm just as helpless against. I know."
"Then you know what my problem is," he said.
"Let's assume for a moment that I'm sometimes an idiot," I said. "What's your problem?"
He gave me a brief smile.
"You were dangerous enough without Mav's hand on you. Now, you can make Lloyd Slate look like a grade school bully."
"But I haven't," I said.
"But you could."
"Maybe I won't."
"Maybe you will."
"If I'm as powerful as you seem to think," I said,
"then what makes you think you can stand up to me?"
He shrugged.
"Maybe I can't. But at least I have a chance.
The people behind me wouldn't."
"Ah," I said. We both sat for a moment. Then I said, "So I guess it won't be good enough for me to tell you that I'm not up to no good."
"You know how you could tell when Slate was lying?"
"How?"
"His lips were moving."
I smiled briefly.
"Well, it seems to me you've got a couple of choices."
"Oh?"
"You do the math. You see what I have the potential to do, and you plan for what I could do rather than what you think I will do."
"Might be smart," Fix said. "Von Clausewitz would say so."
"If this was a war, and I was the enemy, sure."
"What else do you think I could do?"
"Extend a little trust, maybe," I said.
"That's the illusion here, man. As far as I'm concerned, we don't need to be enemies. We don't need to be at war."
Fix pursed his lips. Then he said,
"Here's the problem with that. You belong to Mab. I like Harry. Maybe I could even trust him. But I know what Mab is like. And Harry belongs to Mab now."
"The hell I do," I said. "Just because I took this job doesn't mean I'm all cozy with her." You looked kind of cozy, man, with Mab on the stone table. Sealing a contract like the one with Mab isn't something you do with an impersonal handshake. I felt my cheeks heat up. Oh, you saw that. All of Fairy did, Fix said. God, that's humiliating, I muttered.
I know what you mean, he said. At least it wasn't on pay-per-view.
I snorted. Okay, I said finally. I'm under some pressure here, so I think you need to make a decision.
Yeah?
I nodded. You or von Clausewitz?
Fix looked away. Then he said, I hate this kind of crap.
This is the first time I've had a job I've held down for more than 6 months.
I hear you.
He gave me another brief smile.
I want to believe you, he said.
Then he took a steadying breath and faced me, lowering his arms to his sides again.
But there are people depending on me to keep them safe. I can't afford to do that.
I stood up very slowly and reluctantly.
Fix, I don't want this fight.
And you'll get a chance to avoid it, he said. I'm going to give you until noon to get out of town, Harry. If I see you after that, I'm not going to spend any more time talking, and I'm not going to challenge you to a fair fight. If you're really serious about being your own man, if you really want to keep the peace between us, you'll go.
I don't think I can do that, I said.
I didn't think you could, he said quietly. You have until noon. We exchanged a nod, then he moved back to his SUV, never taking his eyes off me. Once he was in, he started it and drove away. I sank down onto the Hummer's back bumper then and closed my eyes. Great. One more thing. I liked Fix. He was a decent guy. He'd become the Summer Knight, and as far as I knew, he'd never abused his power. People in the supernatural community liked and respected him. I'd even seen him in action once. He was a hell of a lot more formidable than he'd been as the scared young man I'd first met. I didn't want to fight him.
He might not give me a choice.
Mab was not about puppies and kittens, and I'd known that when I signed on. Even if she wasn't evil exactly, she was vicious, violent, and ruthless. I had no doubt that Mab had done for a number of decent people in her time, one way or another. There were stories about the Winter Knight stretching back for centuries, and various vile personalities had held the title. Some of them had even been famous. Gilles de Rais, André Chikatilo, John Haig, Fritz Harman. If I were in Fix's shoes and he were in mine, I might well have pulled the trigger without thinking twice. I leaned my head back against the truck with a little thunk. Thomas sat down next to me and the Hummer settled a little more.
Well?
Well, what?
You going to back off?
Doesn't matter, I said.
Sure it does.
I shook my head.
It doesn't matter because he's a decent guy, and I'm not going to hurt him.
He might not give you much choice.
There's always a choice, I said.
That's the thing, man. There's always, always a choice. My options might really, truly suck, but that doesn't mean there isn't a choice.
You'd let him kill you? Thomas asked.
I looked up at him.
No, but I won't hurt him.
My brother gave me a tight-lipped look, and then got up and walked away. There was a shimmer in the air, and Molly appeared, standing about 10 feet behind what had been Fix's position during our conversation. She watched Thomas go with an unhappy expression. I blinked at her.
How long have you been standing there?
I got out of your side of the car when Thomas got in, she said. You know, just in case something happened. It seemed like a good idea to make sure he went down quick if a fight broke out, so you wouldn't have to kill him.
I smiled at her.
Totally unfair. I had this teacher who kept telling me that if I was ever in a fair fight, someone had made a mistake.
Sounds like a jerk.
He has his moments, she said. She squinted after Thomas and said, He's just afraid, you know. He doesn't want to lose his brother twice.
I know, I said. "But I'm really proud of you, boss," she said, her voice quieter. "I mean, I know you've had some hard calls to make lately. But my dad would say that you were right about this one. There's always a choice." I grunted.
"Oh, if I get into it with Fix," I said, "I don't want you to get involved."
"Why not?"
"Because fairies keep score," I said, "and they'll never leave a score unsettled."
"If I told you that, you'd tell me that wasn't my choice to make."
"And I'd be right," I said, and sighed. "But I have enough worries already, Grasshopper. Leave it alone, for me."
She looked like I just asked her to swallow a bug.
"I'll try," she said.
"Thanks," I said, and extended my hand. She helped me up. "What's next?"
"A phone call. Let's go."
Chapter 20. "I don't care how busy he is," I said into the phone. "I need to talk with him, period." We were in Thomas's living room. Thomas was sprawled on a recliner. The hideous high-tech brushed steel look that had been the place's trademark had been softened with window dressings and various bits of decoration. Justine's touch. Thomas, like most men, regarded a throw pillow as something to throw. One bounced off my chest.
"Way to turn on the charm, Harry," he murmured.
I covered the phone's receiver with one hand. "Polite gets you nowhere with these people, trust me." I turned back to the phone.
"No," I said, "not over this line. It's bugged."
"Just tell him that Donut Boy needs to speak to him or an informed high-level operative in person, within the hour."
Thomas mouthed the word operative at me, his fingers spread in a gesture meant to convey spooky importance. I kicked the pillow back at him.
"Don't give me excuses," I said. "He can get here if he damn well wants to, and we both know it. Call me back at this number." I thunked the phone down.
"Earlier today," Molly said from where she sat on the floor, "someone said something to me about not burning my bridges. Let me think. Who was that?"
"Ixnay," I growled. "I know what I'm doing." I turned to Thomas. "How many bugs does Lara have on this place?"
"Harry," Thomas said in a scandalized tone, one that was just a little bit too well projected to be meant for me. "I'm her brother. She would never behave that way toward her own flesh and blood, her own kin, her own dear sibling." I growled, "How many?" He shrugged.
"It changes. New ones come in sometimes when I'm not home."
I grunted. I put the phone on the counter, unplugged it, and grabbed a pepper shaker. I put a circle of pepper around the phone and sealed it with a gentle effort of will.
"You're set for money, right?"
"With Lara's money, yes."
"Good," I said, and then I unleashed a burst of will with a mutter of Hexus that burned out every bit of electronics within 50 feet. The apartment's light bulbs all winked out at the same instant. Thomas groaned, but he didn't otherwise complain.
"Grasshopper," I said.
"On it," Molly said. She rose to her feet, frowning, her eyes mostly closed, and began walking slowly around the apartment. While she did that, I broke the circle of pepper with a brush of my hand and plugged the phone back in.
"If you were going to do that," Thomas asked, "why not do it before you made the phone call that absolutely did set off every flag Lara's security teams have to wave?"
I held up a hand for silence until Molly had wandered down the hall and back.
"Nothing," she said.
"No spells?" Thomas asked.
"Right," I said. "Anyone who came in uninvited wouldn't be able to make that kind of spell stick. And no one you've invited in has," I frowned.
"Molly?"
"I didn't," she said quickly.
"Has planted a spell to listen in on you," I finished. "And I wanted Lara's people to know who I contacted. When they try to follow up on it, they'll betray their presence, and he'll be alerted to how they operate."
"It was a payment," Thomas said. I shrugged.
"Call it a friendly gesture."
"At my sister's expense," Thomas said.
"Lara's a big girl. She'll understand."
I considered things for a moment and then said,
"Everyone be cool. Something might happen."
Thomas frowned.
"Like what?"
"Cat Sith," I called in a firm voice. "I need you, if you please." There was a rushing sound, like a heavy curtain stirred by a strong wind,
And then, from the fresh, dark shadows beneath Thomas's dining table, the Malk's alien voice said,
"I am here, Sir Knight."
Thomas jerked in reaction, despite my warning, and produced a tiny semi-automatic pistol from I knew not where. Molly drew in a sharp, harsh breath and backed directly away from the source of the voice until her shoulder blades hit a wall. It was just possible that I had understated how unsettling a Malk sounds when it speaks. I'd clearly been hanging around creepy things for way too long. "Take it easy," I said, holding a hand out to Thomas. "This is Cat Sith." Molly made a sputtering noise. I gave her a quelling glance and said to Thomas, "He's working with me." Cat Sith came to the edge of the shadows so that his silhouette could be seen. His eyes reflected the light from the almost entirely curtained windows.
"Sir Knight, how may I assist you?"
"Empty night it talks," Thomas breathed.
"How?" Molly asked. "The threshold here is solid. How did it just come in like that?"
Which was a reasonable question, given that Molly didn't know about my former cleaning service and how it had interacted with my old apartment's threshold. "Beings out of fairy don't necessarily need to be invited over a threshold," I said. "If they're benevolent to the inhabitants of the house, they can pretty much come right in." "Wait," Thomas said. "These freaks can walk in and out whenever they want? Pop in directly from the never-never, and you didn't tell us about it?" "Only if their intentions are benign," I said. "Cat Sith came here to assist me, and by extension, you. As long as he's here, he's..." I frowned and looked at the Malk. "Help me find the correct way to explain this to him." Sith directed his eyes to Thomas and said,
"While I am here, I am bound by the same traditions as would apply were I your invited guest," he said. "I will offer no harm to anyone you have accepted into your home, nor take any action which would be considered untoward for a guest. I will report nothing of what I see and hear in this place, and make every effort to aid and assist your household and other guests while I remain."
I blinked several times. I had expected Sith to hit me with a big old snark club, rather than actually answering the question. Much less answering it in such detail. But that made sense. The obligations of guest and host were almost wholly in the supernatural world. If Sith truly did regard that kind of courtesy as the obligation of a guest, he would have little choice but to live up to it. Thomas seemed to digest that for a few moments and then grunted, "I suppose I am obliged to comport myself as a proper host, then."
"Say instead that I am under no obligation to allow myself to be harmed, or to remain and give my aid if you behave in any other fashion."
Sith corrected him.
"If you began shooting at me with that weapon, for example, I would depart without doing harm, and only then would I hunt you, catch you outside the protection of your threshold, and kill you in order to discourage such behavior from others in the future."
Thomas looked like he was about to talk some smack at the Malk, but only for a second. Then he frowned and said, "It's odd. You sound like a grade school teacher."
"Perhaps it is because I am speaking to a child," Cat Sith said. "The comparison is apt."
Thomas blinked several times and then looked at me. "Did the evil kitty just call me a child?" "I don't think he's evil so much as hyper-violent and easily bored," I said. "And you started it. You called him a freak." My brother pursed his lips and frowned. "I did, didn't I?" He turned to Cat Sith and set his gun aside. "Cat Sith, the remark was not directed specifically at you or meant to insult you, but I acknowledge that I have given offense and recognize that the slight puts me in your debt. Please accept my apologies, and feel free to ask a commensurate service of me should you ever have need of it to balance the scales." Cat Sith stared at Thomas for a moment and then inclined his head.
"Even children can learn manners. Done. Until such time as I have need of you, I regard the matter as settled, Thomas Wraith.
You know him? I asked.
And your apprentice, Molly Carpenter,
Sith said, his voice impatient.
As well as the rest of your frequent associates. May I suggest that you get on with the business at hand, Sir Knight? Tempus fugit.
One of the Winter's most dangerous creatures, most dangerous hunters, knew all about my friends. That was something that a smart man would be concerned about. I reminded myself that just because someone is courteous, it does not necessarily mean that they aren't planning to vivisect you. It just means that they'll ask whether the ropes holding you down are comfortable before they pick up a scalpel. Cat Sith might be an ally for the moment, but he was not my friend. In a few minutes, we're going to be leaving, I said. I've got a hunch that we'll be under observation, and I don't want that. I want you to distract anyone who has us under direct surveillance.
With pleasure.
Without killing them or causing significant bodily harm, I said. For all I know, there's a cop or a PI watching the place, so nothing permanent. Cat Sith narrowed his eyes, his tail twitched to one side, but he said nothing. Think of it as a compliment, I suggested. Any idiot could murder them. What I ask is far more difficult, as befits your station. His tail twitched the other way. He said nothing. After that, I said, I want you to get word to the Summer Lady. I want a meeting. What? Thomas said. Is that a good idea? Molly asked at the same time. I waved a hand at both of them and kept talking to Sith. Tell her it's got to happen before noon. Can you contact her?
Of course, Sir Knight, said Sith. She will wish to know the reason for such a meeting.
Tell her that I'd prefer not to kill her knight, and I'd like to discuss how best to avoid it. Tell her that I'll meet her wherever she pleases, if she promises me safe conduct. Bring me her answer. Sith eyed me, then said,
Such a course is unwise.
I'm not asking you to do it. What do you care?
The Queen may be less than pleased with me if I break her newest toy before she's gotten sufficient use from it.
Gosh, I said. Sith flicked an ear and managed to do it contemptuously.
I will bear this message, Sir Knight, and I will distract those who hunt you. When will you be departing?
Behind me, Thomas's phone began to ring. Tell you in a second, I said. I answered the phone. Go for Donut Boy. A woman with a voice cold enough to merit the use of a Kelvin scale spat.
He will meet you. Accorded neutral ground. 10 minutes.
Cool, I said. I haven't had a beer in forever. There was a brief, perhaps baffled silence, and then she hung up on me. I turned back to Thomas and Molly and said, Let's go. Sith, please be... The eldest Malk vanished. Gin, I finished, somewhat lamely. Thomas swung to his feet and slipped the little automatic into the back of his pants, then pulled his shirt down over it. Where are we going?
Accorded neutral ground, I said.
Oh, good, Molly said. I'm starving.
Chapter 21 In the lobby, we found the doorman sitting on the ground, grimacing in pain. A CPD patrol officer was next to him with a first aid kit. As we passed, I saw several long, long slices in the back of one of the doorman's legs, running from just above his heel to the top of his calf. His slacks and socks alike were sliced in neat, parallel strips. The wounds were painful and bloody, but not life-threatening. Both men were too preoccupied to pay an instant of attention to the three of us as we calmly left the building. I winced a little as we went by them. Damn it. I hadn't wanted to turn even the gentlest of Cat Sith's attentions upon any of my fellow Chicagoans, but I hadn't worded my command to him tightly enough. Of course, that was a rabbit hole I didn't want to start down. Experience has taught me that you do not win against supernatural entities at lawyering. It just doesn't happen. I didn't even want to think about what Sith might have done if I hadn't forbidden him the use of deadly force.
Maybe this was the Malk's way of telling me to beware the consequences if I kept giving him commands like a common servant. Or maybe this was his idea of playing nice. After all, he hadn't slashed up the cop and every passerby. For all I knew, he thought he'd been a perfect gentleman. Molly checked out the parking garage from beneath a veil while Thomas and I waited. Once she pronounced the garage villain-free, we got into my brother's troop transport and left. In Chicago, you can't swing a cat without hitting an Irish pub and angering the cat. But McAnally's place stands out from the crowd. It's the favored watering hole for the supernatural scene of Chicago. Normals never really seem to find their way in, though we get some tourists once in a while. They rarely linger. Morning traffic was roaring at full steam, and even though Max wasn't far, it took us a little time to get there. Clouds had swallowed up the bright dawn, thick and gray. A light rain was falling. Occasionally I could see flashes of distant lightning glowing through the clouds overhead, or hear a subtle growl of low thunder.
"And it was supposed to be nice today," Molly murmured.
I smiled a little, but didn't say anything. Thomas pulled into the little parking lot adjacent to Max, parking his Hummer next to an old white Trans Am. He stopped, frowning at it. "I thought Mac usually opened up at noon," he said. 11, I said. My old office building hadn't been far away. I'd eaten many a lunch at Mac's place.
"Guess he came in early today."
"That's handy," Thomas said.
"Where does that saying come from?"
I asked. Thomas said, "handy?" I blinked as we walked. "Well, yeah, that one too, but I was thinking of the phrase, you can't swing a cat without hitting something around here." Thomas gave me a steady look. "Don't you have important things to be thinking about right now?" I shrugged. "I wonder about these things. Life goes on, man. If I stop thinking about things just because some psycho or crew of psychos wants me dead, I'll never get to think about anything, will I?" Thomas bobbed his head to one side in acknowledgement of my point. About 30 feet from the door, Molly abruptly stopped in her tracks and said,
"Harry?"
I paused and looked back at her. Her eyes were wide. She said,
"I sense..."
I narrowed my eyes.
"Say it. You know you want to say it."
"It is not a disturbance in the force," she said, her voice half exasperated.
"There's a presence here. Something powerful. I felt it in Chichen Itza."
"Good," I said, nodding. "He's here." "Seriously, neither of you guys know where that saying comes from?"
"Damn.
I hate not knowing things. It's enough to make a guy wish he could use the internet." Mac's pub was all but empty. It's a place that looks pretty spacious when empty, yet it's small enough to feel cozy when it's full. It's a study in deliberate asymmetry. There are 13 tables of varying sizes and heights scattered irregularly around the floor. There are 13 wooden columns, placed in similarly random positions, their faces carved with scenes from old-world nursery tales. The bar kind of meanders, and there are 13 stools spaced unevenly along it. Just about everything is made from wood, including the paneled walls, the hardwood floors, and the paneled ceiling. 13 ceiling fans hang suspended from the ceiling, ancient things that Mac manages to keep running despite the frequent presence of magical talents. The decor is kind of feng shui, or at least something close to it. All that imbalance is intended to scatter the random outbursts of magical energy that cause problems for practitioners. It must work. The electric fans and the telephone hardly ever melt down. Mac stood behind the bar, a lean man a little taller than average, his shaven head gleaming. I've patronized his establishment for most of my adult life, and he still looked more or less like he had when I first met him. Neat, dressed in dark pants, a white shirt, and a pristine white apron that proved its ongoing redundancy by never getting messy. Mac was leaning on the bar, listening to something the pub's only other occupant was saying. The second man was well over 6 feet tall, and built with a kind of broad shoulders and lean power that made me think of a long-distance swimmer. He wore a dark gray business suit, an immaculate European number of some kind, obviously custom-made. His hair was the color of old steel, highlighted with sweeps of silver,
and his sharp chin and jawline were emphasized by the cut of a short, silver-white beard. The man wore a black eye patch made of silk, and even against the backdrop of that suit, it gave him a piratical aura. The man in the eye patch finished saying whatever it was, and Mac dropped his head back and let out a short, hefty belly laugh. It lasted only a second, and then it was gone, replaced with Mac's usual calm, genial expression. But the man in the suit sat back with an expression of pleasure on his face at the reaction.
"It's him," Molly said. "Who is that?"
"Donar Vatarung," I told her.
"Whoa," Thomas said. Molly frowned.
The security company guy?"
"CEO of Monarch Securities," I said, nodding.
"Empty night, Dresden," Thomas said. "You just demanded that he come to see you."
"Is that bad?" Molly asked him.
"It's..." Thomas said. "Think of doing that to Donald Trump or George Soros."
Molly winced.
"I'm not sure I can do that."
Thomas glared at me.
"You set up Lara's surveillance crew to go up against his guys?"
I smiled.
"Balls," Thomas said. "She's going to rip mine off."
"Tell her it wasn't your fault. You couldn't have stopped me. She'll get it," I said.
"You guys sit down, get some food or something. This shouldn't take long." Molly blinked, then looked at Thomas and said,
"Wait a minute. We're his flunkies?"
"You, maybe," Thomas said, sneering. "I'm his thug. I'm way higher than a flunky."
"You are high if you think I'm taking any orders from you," Molly said tartly.
The two of them went to a far table, bickering cheerfully, and sat down, passing by the real reason we were meeting here, a modest wooden sign with simple letters burned into it, Accorded Neutral Territory. The Unseelie Accords had supported the various supernatural political entities over the past few turbulent decades. They were a series of agreements that, at the end of the day, were basically meant to limit conflicts between the various nations to something with a definite structure. They defined the rights of those lords who held territory, as well as the infractions that could be committed against those lords by other lords. Think of them as the Geneva Conventions of the spooky side. That's kind of close. Mac had somehow gotten his place declared neutral ground. It meant that whenever any signatory of the Accords was here, he was obligated to be a good guest, to offer no harm or violence to any other signatory, and to take any violence that might erupt outside. It was a meeting ground, where there was at least a fair chance that you might actually get to finish a meal without being murdered by someone who might otherwise be a mortal enemy. Vatarung watched Molly and Thomas sit, and then transferred his attention back to me. His single eye was an icy shade of blue and unsettling. As I approached him, I had an instinctive impression that he could see more of me than I could of him.
"Well, well, well," he said. "Rumors of your death, etc." I shrugged.
"I'm sure it isn't an uncommon play among wizards," I said. Something in his eye flashed, an amused thought that went by almost before I could see it.
"Fewer try it than you might think," he said.
"I didn't try anything," I said. "It just happened." Vatarung reached out and lazily collected a cup of coffee. He sipped it, watching me. Then he leaned forward slightly and said slowly,
"Nothing that significant just happens, Dresden."
I squinted at him, shrugged. Then I said,
"Mac, can I get a beer?"
Mac had sauntered a discreet distance down the bar. He eyed me, and then a slowly ticking clock on the wall.
"I haven't had a drink in a lifetime," I said. "If I go all nutty about it, you can sign me up for AA.
Mac snorted. Then he got me a bottle of one of his micro-brewed ales. They were nectar and ambrosia. He opened it and passed me the bottle. Since he knew I rarely drink beer out of a glass, and I tilted it toward him before drinking some.
"Pretty early for that, isn't it?" Vatarung asked.
"I can smell the whiskey in yours from here," I said, and held up my bottle. He smiled, lifted his coffee cup toward me in salute, and took a long sip as I put back some more ale. Then we both set our drinks down.
"What do you need?" Vatarung asked.
"Advice," I said, "if the price is right."
And what do you think a sufficient price would be?
Lucy charges a nickel.
Ah, Vaderung said. But Lucy is a psychiatrist. You realize that you've just cast yourself as Charlie Brown.
Ugh, I said.
Vaderung smiled. You found it lonely where you were, I see.
Why would you say that? The banter, the talk, unnecessary companions.
Many would say that now is the time for rapid, decisive action. But you have spent precious time reconnecting with your allies.
He tilted his head slightly.
Therefore, if you have such a driving need for it, I can logically assume that you have spent your recent time apart from such company. Does that seem reasonable to you?
Arctis Tor isn't much of a vacation spot, I said.
No. What is it?
I narrowed my eyes.
Wait, are you trying to shrink me?
He sipped his coffee.
Why would you ask me that question?
Because you keep asking questions, I said. Joke's on you, Lucy. I don't have a nickel. I regarded my bottle. I've got time for banter, just not for games.
Vaderung set his coffee down and spread his hands.
I don't work for free, he said.
I haven't earned enough money in my entire lifetime to afford your fees, I said.
But you don't need more money.
He waited.
I'll owe you one, I said.
That seemed to amuse the hell out of him. Wrinkled topography appeared at the corner of his eye.
Given the caliber of your talents for making enemies, I hope you'll understand if I don't consider what you offer a sound long-term value.
I smiled and sipped some beer. But it's worth a few minutes of your time, or you wouldn't have come here in the first place.
That drew a quick flicker of an amused smile.
I will accept your offer of one favor, and a nickel.
I told you I don't have a nickel.
He nodded gravely.
What do you have?
I rummaged in my pockets and came out with the jeweled cufflinks from my tux. I showed them to him.
Those aren't a nickel, he said soberly.
He leaned forward again, as he had a moment before, and spoke slowly.
What do you have?
I stared at him for a second. Then I said, friends. He sat back, his blue eye all but throwing off sparks, it was so bright. Thomas, I called, I need a nickel.
What? Thomas asked. In cash?
Yeah. Thomas reached into a pocket and produced a bunch of plastic cards. He fanned them out and showed them to me.
What about these?
Those aren't a nickel, I said.
Oh, for goodness sake, Molly sighed.
She reached into a pocket and produced what looked like a little old lady's coin purse. Then she flicked a nickel toward me.
I caught it.
Thanks, you're promoted to lackey. She rolled her eyes.
Hail Ming.
I slid the nickel across the bar to Vaderung.
There.
He nodded.
Talk to me.
Right, I said. It's about time.
No, he said. It's about your island.
I eyed him warily. What do you mean?
What I mean, he said, is that I know about your island. I know where it came from. I know what it does. I know what's beneath it.
Ah, I said.
Oh. I am aware of how important it is that the island be well managed. Most of the people who came to your party in Mexico are.
By which he meant the Grey Council. Vaderung was a part of it. It was a group of folks, mostly wizards of the White Council, who had joined together because it seemed like the White Council was getting close to meltdown, and they wanted to save it. But since the rats were in the walls, the only way to do it was covertly, working in cells. I wasn't sure who exactly was a member, except for my grandfather and Vaderung. He had come along with the rest of the mostly anonymous Grey Council when I'd gone to take my daughter back from the Red Court, and seemed to fit right in.
Of course, I was pretty sure he wasn't a wizard. I was pretty sure he was a lot more than that.
So I broke it down for him, speaking very quietly. I told him about the attack being aimed at the island from across time. Hard lines appeared in his face as I did.
Idiots, he breathed. Even if they could defeat the Banefire.
Wait, I said. Banefire?
The failsafe, Vaderung said. The fire the island showed you.
Right, it'll kill everything held there, rather than let them escape, right?
It is the only way, Badarung said. If anyone managed to set free the things in the well...
Seems like it would be bad, I said.
Not bad, Badarung said. The end.
Oh, I said. Good to know. The island didn't mention that part.
The island cannot accept it as a possibility, Badarung said absently.
It should probably put its big girl pants on, then, I said. The way I understand it, it might already be too late. I mean, for all I know, someone cast this spell 100 years ago, or 100 years from now.
Badarung waved his hand. Nonsense. There are laws that govern the progression of time in relation to space, like everything else.
Meaning what?
Meaning that the echoes caused by the temporal event are proportionally greater than the span of time that was bridged, he said. Had the attack been launched from a century ago or hence, the echoes of it would have begun far, far in advance of the event, centuries ago. These echoes have appeared only within the past few days. I would guess roughly that the attack must originate only hours from the actual real-time occurrence.
Which is tomorrow, I said. So it's happening sometime today or sometime tomorrow.
Most likely not tomorrow, Badarung said. Altering one's past is more than mildly difficult.
The paradox thing, I said. Like if I go back and kill my grandfather, how was I ever born to go back and kill my grandfather?
Paradox is an overrated threat. There is a quality similar to inertia at work. Once an event has occurred, there is an extremely strong tendency for that event to occur. The larger, more significant, or more energetic the event, the more it tends to remain as it originally happened, despite any interference.
I frowned. There's a law of the conservation of history?
Badarung grinned. I have never heard it phrased quite like that, but it's accurate enough. In any event, overcoming that inertia requires tremendous energy, will, and a measure of simple luck. If one wishes to alter the course of history, it's a far simpler matter to attempt to shape the future. I grunted. So if I go back in time and kill my grandfather, what happens?
He beats you senseless, I suspect, Badarung said, his gaze direct.
Oh, man. Badarung knew about Ebenezer, which meant that either he was higher in the old man's circle of trust than I was, or he had access to an astoundingly scary pool of information.
You know what I mean, I said. Paradox, universe goes poof.
If it works like that, I have never seen it, as evidenced by the fact that... He spread his hands. Here it is. I suspect a different form of apocalypse happens.
I frowned.
Like what?
A twinned universe, Badarung said.
A new parallel reality, identical except for that event. One in which you never existed, and one in which you failed to kill your grandfather.
I pursed my lips. That doesn't really end well for me in either case.
An excellent reason not to meddle in the natural course of time, wouldn't you say? Meddling with time is an irrationally, outrageously, catastrophically dangerous and costly business. I encourage you to avoid it at all costs.
You and the White Council, I said.
So, it's going to happen sometime today or tonight.
Badarung nodded.
And nearby.
Why?
Because the energy requirements are astronomical, he said. Bridging a temporal gap of any length is something utterly beyond the reach of any mortal practitioner acting alone. Doing such a thing and then trying to project a spell over a distance as well, the difficulty of it would be prohibitive. And do not forget how much water surrounds the island, which will tend to mitigate any energy sent toward it.
That's one reason the well was built there.
I nodded. All of that hung together, based upon everything I knew of magic. People always assume that magic is a free ride, but it isn't. You can't pull energy from nowhere, and there are laws that govern how it behaves.
So this time bomb, it has to come from how close, I asked.
The shores of the lake, I suspect, Badarung said. The island itself would be the ideal location, but I doubt that it will cooperate with any such effort.
Not hardly, I agreed.
and you can't just scribble a chalk circle and pull this spell out of your hat. It's got to have an energy source, a big one.
Precisely, Vatterung said.
And those things tend to stand out.
He smiled.
They do.
And whoever is trying to pull this off, if they know enough about futzing with time to be making this attempt, they know that the echoes will warn people that it's coming. They'll be ready to argue with anyone who tries to thwart them.
They most certainly will, he finished his coffee.
I had made the right call here. Vatterung's advice had changed the problem from something enormous and inexplicable to something that was merely very difficult, very dangerous, and likely to get me killed.
I said, don't take this the wrong way, but this is a high-stakes game.
The highest, yes, he agreed.
I'm thinking that maybe someone with a little more experience and better footing should handle it. Someone like you, maybe.
He shook his head. It isn't practical.
I frowned.
Not practical?
It must be you.
Why me?
It's your island, Vatterung said.
That makes no sense.
He tilted his head and looked at me.
Wizard, you have been dead and returned. It has marked you. It has opened doors and paths that you do not yet know exist, and attracted the attention of beings who formerly would never have taken note of your insignificance.
Meaning what? I asked.
There was no humor at all in his face.
Meaning that now, more than ever, you are a fulcrum. Meaning that your life is about to become very, very interesting.
I don't understand, I said.
He leaned forward slightly.
Correct that.
He looked at his watch and rose.
I'm afraid I'm out of time.
I shook my head, rising with him, blocking him.
Wait. My plate is already pretty full here, and if you haven't noticed, I'm barely competent to keep myself alive, much less to prevent Arkham Asylum from turning into the next Tunguska blast.
Vatterung met my eyes with his and said in a growl,
Move. I moved.
I looked away, too. I'd seen too many things with my sight already, and I had a bad feeling that trading a soul gaze with Vatterung would not improve my performance over the next day or so.
Where are Hugin and Munin? I asked.
I left them at the office, he said. They don't like you, I'm afraid.
Bird brains, I muttered.
He smiled, nodded to Mac, and walked to the door.
Can I do this? I asked his back.
You can.
I made an exasperated sound.
How do you know?
Odin turned to look back at me with his gleaming eye, his teeth bared in a wolf's smile, the scar on either side of his eye patch silver in the light coming through the door.
Perhaps, he murmured, you already have.
Then he opened the door and left.
I scowled at where he'd been standing and then slouched back down on my bar stool. I grabbed my beer, finished it, and set it back down a little harder than I had to.
Mac was back at the grill making some of his famous steak sandwiches for Thomas and Molly. I waved at him, but before I could say anything, he had already added another steak to the first two. My stomach growled as I got up and went to Molly and Thomas's table.
Perhaps you already have. Now what the hell had he meant by that?
Chapter 22. I filled Molly and Thomas in on what I'd learned from Vatterung while we ate. Mac's steak sandwiches were too awesome not to eat, even if it was more or less breakfast time. Molly blinked as I finished.
Who is that guy?
Thomas gave me an even look. My brother had worked it out. He tilted his head microscopically toward Molly.
A friend, I think. When you work it out, you're ready to know.
Molly frowned and toyed with a few breadcrumbs, pushing them around with a forefinger. She nodded.
Okay.
So what's next? Thomas asked.
I finished the last few bites of my sandwich in a hurry.
Man, that tasted good.
I washed it down with some more of Mac's excellent beer. Normally a couple of bottles along with a meal would leave me ready for a nap. Today they felt about as soporific as Red Bull.
Molly, I said, I want you to go talk to Toot.
I need the guard to gather up and be ready to move when I give the word.
Scouts? She guessed.
I nodded. While you're doing that, I'm going to figure out the potential sites for the time bomb spell, so we know where to aim the guard. Order some pizza. That'll gather them in.
Okay, she said. Money?
I looked at Thomas. She already came through for me once. Your turn. Thomas snorted and slipped a white plastic card out of his pocket. It was utterly unmarked except for a few stamped numbers and a magnetic strip. He flicked it across the table to Molly.
When you get your pizza, have them run that.
Molly studied the card back and front.
Is this a diner's club card or something?
It's a Wraith contingency card, he said. Lara hands them out to the family. Once they ring up the first charge on the card, it'll be good for 24 hours.
For how much? Molly asked.
24 hours, Thomas repeated.
Molly lifted her eyebrows. Thomas smiled faintly. Don't worry about amounts. My sister doesn't really believe in limits. Do whatever you want with it. I don't care. Molly took the card and placed it very carefully in her second-hand coin purse.
Okay, she looked at me. Now?
I nodded. Get a move on. She paused to draw a pen from her purse. She scribbled on a napkin and passed it to me.
My apartment's phone.
I glanced at it, read it, and memorized it. Then I slid it to Thomas, who tucked the napkin away in a pocket.
You're going to send her out there alone?
Molly regarded Thomas blankly,
then vanished.
Oh, Thomas said. Right.
I stood up and crossed the room to the door. I opened it and glanced out, as though scanning suspiciously for anyone's approach. I felt Molly slip out past me as I did. Then I closed it again and came back inside. Thunder rumbled over the lake, but no rain fell.
I noticed, my brother drawled, that you didn't leave her a way to contact you.
Did you? He snorted. You think Fix would hurt her?
I think she won't give him much choice, I said. She's come a long way, but Fix is exactly the wrong kind of threat for her to mess with.
He's used to glamour, he can defend against it, and he's smart.
Molly's not too shabby herself, Thomas said. Molly is my responsibility, I said.
I hadn't meant for the words to come out that cold, that hard. The anger surprised me, but it bubbled and seethed still. Some part of me was furious at Thomas for questioning my decision regarding my apprentice. Molly was mine, and I would be damned if some chisel-jawed white court pretty boy was going to... I closed my eyes and clenched my jaw. Pride, possession, territoriality. That wasn't me. That was the mantle of winter talking through me. Sorry, I said a moment later and opened my eyes.
Thomas hadn't reacted in any way to my snarl, my anger, or my apology.
He just studied me, then he said quietly,
I want to suggest something to you. I'm not trying to make you do anything. You just need to hear it.
Sure, I said.
I'm a predator, Harry, he said. We both know that.
Yeah, so?
So I recognize it in others when I see it.
And?
And you're looking at Molly like she's food.
I frowned at him.
I am not.
He shrugged.
It isn't all the time. It's just little moments. You look at her, and I can see the calculations running. You notice every time she yawns.
I didn't want what Thomas was saying to be true.
So what? When she yawns, she's showing us that she's tired. It makes us notice because tired prey is easy prey.
He leaned forward, putting one arm on the table. I know what I'm talking about.
No, I said, my voice getting cold again. You don't.
I tried going into denial like that when I was about 15. It didn't work out too well.
What? I asked him. You think I'm going to attack her when she goes to sleep?
Yeah, he said. If you don't recognize what's motivating you and control it, you will. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but eventually. You can't just ignore those instincts, man. If you do, they'll catch you off guard some night, and you will hurt her one way or another.
I wasn't sure what to say to that. I frowned down at my empty bottle of ale. She trusts you, Thomas said. I think some part of you knows that. I think that part sent her away from you for a damn good reason.
Take this seriously, Harry.
Yeah, I said quietly. I'll try. This stuff keeps catching me off guard.
Nature of the beast. You've always been good at keeping things right between the two of you, even though she's carrying a torch the size of a building. I admire you for that. I'd hate to see it come apart.
I rubbed at my eyes. My brother was right. I'd been forcing myself to look away from Molly all morning. That had never been an issue before. That was part of winter, too. Hunger and lust, a need for heat in the darkness. It had driven Lloyd Slate, just as it had several other winter nights over the years. It had driven them insane. I had to learn to recognize that influence before someone got hurt.
Yeah, okay, I said. When I get done sprinting from one forest fire to the next, I'll figure something out. Until then, feel free to slap me around a bit if you think I need it.
Thomas nodded very seriously, but his eyes sparkled. I'm your brother. I pretty much always feel free to do that. I said, I'd like to see you.
I trailed off, glancing at Mac, who was staring at the door to the pub, frowning. I followed his gaze. The glass on the top half of the door was faceted and partly frosted, but it was clear enough to give you a blurry image of whoever was standing outside the door. Or at least it would have been if the exterior hadn't been blanketed by a thick gray mist.
Thomas noticed me and looked.
Huh, he said. Doesn't the fog usually burn off in the morning?
We didn't have any this morning, I said.
So, Thomas drawled, that isn't right.
No, I said. No, it isn't.
There just weren't all that many reasons someone would blanket an area with mist.
To conceal an approach. We both stood up and faced the door. Behind us, Mac reached under the bar and came out with a pistol-grip shotgun made of black composite material. It had a folding stock and barely enough of a barrel to qualify as a hunting piece.
This is crazy, Thomas said. Nobody attacks Max. It's neutral ground.
What about these Fomor I've heard about?
Not even them, Thomas said. Every time they've gotten close to this place, the BFS came down on them like an avalanche. It's practically the only thing they've really agreed on.
I blanked for a second and then said,
Oh, Brighter Future Society.
It isn't the fairies, is it? Thomas asked.
They're called the Unseelie Accords, I said. Winter equals Unseelie. Anyone in winter who violated Mab's treaty would be thrilled to die before she was through with them.
Summer, then?
It isn't noon yet, I said. The sounds of the city outside had vanished. An unnatural hush fell. I could hear three people breathing a little harder than they normally would, a creaky ceiling fan, and that was about it.
Definitely magic, I said.
Someone doesn't want anybody seeing or hearing what happens in here.
There was a sharp sound, a sudden motion, and a stone sailed through one of the faceted panes of glass on the door. Thomas produced his pistol, and Mac's shotgun snapped up to his shoulder. Some broken glass tinkled to the floor, and the stone tumbled down and bounced off my foot before it came to rest on the floor. It was a rounded piece of black, glassy obsidian, about the size of an egg. Tendrils of mist came through the broken pane of glass, and the stone on the floor abruptly quivered and began to buzz. Thomas and I both took several wary steps away from it, but the buzzing increased and warped until it became an eerie, quavering voice, like something you'd hear on an old, worn-out vinyl record.
"Send out the wizard,"
it hummed, each word slow and drawn out.
"Send him to us, and all others may stay."
"I know a good place for you to pound sand, you gutless fuck," Thomas began helpfully.
I held up a hand. "No," I told him quietly. "Wait." "For what?"
This is neutral territory, I said in a voice pitched to carry outside the door. If you want to talk, come on in. You won't be attacked.
Send him to us.
That wasn't creepy or anything. My schedule is kind of full today, I called. How's next Tuesday for you?